All right. I mean, we're going to be totally casual, to be honest. Like, I have no idea what I'm going to ask. I have no topic in mind. This was just, let's get Jim Nasser sitting with me and chatting from Acor.
Love it.
But honestly, I think everybody's going to know about Acor, or there's plenty of resources to find out about Acor. So I'm more interested in Jim than Acor right now. Right. We've been in this space for a few years together. I think it's been 5 years.
Yeah.
Hedera 18, is that when you...
Even before, in 17.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in 2017, like, what really got your attention?
So in...
That was pre-Hedera, by the way. So.
It was the early swirls.
Yeah.
Right. Or the Hashgraph algorithm.
That's right.
The SDK that came out. So about a year before, in 2016, when I was at the CDC, we had this...
Hold up. You were at the CDC?
Yeah. I was the chief cyber architect at the Centers for Disease Control.
No way.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yep. I'm way more interested in that part now.
So to me, the CDC is probably the most, those 2 years were the most impactful in the sense of how the future of my career was channeled, right? Not necessarily shaped, mm-hmm. but the way that, like, the attention, the focus, understanding what are the big problems, where things are broken. It was during those 2 years that I realized, oh, wow, this is different to what I knew. It's much bigger. It's much more nuanced. But also, it was around that time, and you may have heard this, Ken, that my father, you know, had some health issues, I grew up in the UK in Brighton. And, you know, he was there by himself. And he was left alone. And the care and the treatment that I thought he was having was actually not at all what was the case. And there were miscommunications, redundant electronic or paper records, and all everything that you kind of can think of as being messed up in healthcare was happening, but was happening to my father. And I grew up with him. And I was 4,000 miles away in Atlanta, and he's in the UK. So it was really the combination of what was happening to me, well, to my father personally, its impact on me, and what I was learning at the CDC that really was a confluence of factors to say, or to make me really double down on this area of healthcare innovation. And then really trying to get to the next question, which led to Hedera, which is, how do I know what's real? Like, what is the right information? Is it what you're telling me or what somebody else is telling me? How do I know that this information hasn't changed? How do I know that that's information that I agreed to and somebody else hasn't changed? All these questions that, like, you know, it's shaped in the form of consent, you know, in the form of provenance, if you like, and things like this. But so in 2016, this innovation team and I that were working on modernizing the scientific application in CDC for public health came on the idea of, look, anything with the word public in it, such as public health reporting, that's what we're doing.
Yep.
What's called syndromic surveillance for infectious diseases, which is really all to do with getting data, public health data, from different jurisdictions, from county, from villages and cities and counties and states, all the way to the federal level. How do we know that this information, you know, can be trusted, right? Because we're looking at the CDC, but we're looking at aggregate level and making decisions at the federal agency level that would impact everyone. But if you couldn't trust the data, or if the real data was actually the thing that was faxed 6 months ago, not the thing on an Excel spreadsheet, how are we making decisions that then don't impact people's lives?
I was going to say things like that, where using old data to make today's decisions.
Exactly.
Or inaccurate data to make today's decisions. I could see that being a massive problem, just thinking of the bureaucracy of regulators and government entities and agencies.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, we all saw this, all of us, you know, with COVID, in a really bad way, in a far more extreme way that I was imagining back in the day. But going back to the genesis of why blockchain, this was before Adara. How do we find a way to trust this without creating yet another silo, yet another agency, yet another department? Like, we're going to trust the Ken Department of Public Health Reporting. Well, what if Ken retires? You know, what if, you know, it's not Ken who's actually doing the work, but people who don't know what they're doing. What if any number of what ifs? So that was where this idea of, oh, wow, there's this public ledger. And we could figure out, and even really early, we figured out how we could be privacy preserving, how we could do things so we're not putting patient records or anything that's sensitive or could be de-engineered and would become a real issue, public health issue or any kind of like individual consumer issue on the chain, but yet still use the power of this immutability, the transparency, this auditability, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So we built our own Ethereum network at the CDC. We put a few nodes and we experimented. We used MetaMask in its very earliest stage. And there were all kinds of issues. It was slow. It was like testing, of course. Spending gas, the MetaMask usability was horrible. There were all kinds of issues. We were like, there must be a better way of doing this. So, and then that was around the time in I think, September of 17, when mm-hmm. I think the TechCrunch event had happened.
That's right.
And all of a sudden, we're hearing about this Hashgraph thing.
It was the blockchain killer. That was the article that came out.
Right, exactly. So
Andrew wrote.
Exactly. So I literally talked to Ben Chevalier, who is our CTO, and we have been working together for years. Ben, stop. We got to download this SDK and play with this because this could be the actual answer to the problems we're trying to solve theoretically, because we knew that what we're doing with Ethereum and what we're doing with the tooling just was never going to work. It was too slow. It was too expensive. It was too clunky. We didn't want to go down the smart contract path. We're huge believers in open APIs. We're huge believers in interoperability off the chain, if you like. So we saw the purpose for blockchain, and it wasn't everything. But we also knew that what we're working with wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to be real time. It wasn't going to scale. It wasn't going to be cheap enough. It wasn't going to be an experience that our clients would say, oh, wow, that's improved our lives.
Right.
It would just be another silo, and we didn't want to create yet another silo. So we were excited, and of course, you know, in those early days, maybe the promise.
And that was pre-public ledger, too. Like, we're talking, this is the SDK, so you're talking to Manson Lehman for a license to use the SDK with maybe the promise of making the Hashgraph itself visible.
Absolutely.
And transparent to the public. So, as opposed to being a silo, which is closed off and you only get to see whatever the reports kick out.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's still potentially a private network, but at least people can see what's going on in this private network. And it's all mathematically and cryptographically proven. And I've seen this a ton of times too, in some of the things you're mentioning in government. Like, the meme of government worker right now is like the person who does as little as possible to not get reprimanded. And if they do less than what they're supposed to do, then they get promoted to move them out of the unit. And it's like, you know, you think about the inefficiencies of that, but then you look at the department and I think, you know, when they built that department, I think the first generation that worked in that department probably had all the best intents. To your point, you know, Ken's public record API, right? As long as Ken's there, this thing's going to take off. But as soon as it grows beyond Ken or Ken moves on, it's like the people who follow up, it's now just a day-to-day job and it's not as important. And I think we see that time and again with government entities and regulators and agencies is that, you know, the first generation are very passionate about what they're doing. The next generation starts to get a little bit lazy. And then after a while, it's just another thing. And they don't understand the underlying motivation. And I think that is really more about aligning incentives. And when you put things on a public network and make it transparent, there's an organic incentive not to look like an idiot or look inefficient. It's almost like you're constantly on display.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that transparency helps with even the efficiencies of the human behavior side. So I can see how you being in the CDC, probably seeing some of those inefficiencies internally, but also just seeing like how messed up the entire system is. Did you feel like you had a strong enough technical position to overcome a lot of that political, like, I'm sure there was plenty of political friction very early on with what you were doing?
Yes and no, Ken. So I was brought in as an entrepreneur in residence. I had already had a tech startup for years and exited, and had worked with a number of government agencies, including intelligence and, you know, very, very big projects. So,
okay, we got to pause real quick. Okay.
Yeah.
This is the Jim story here, right? This is not the Hedera story. So I appreciate how we got to Acor.
Yeah.
But now we got to go back and talk about what was it that you built that you exited from? That's a big deal. You had a liquidity event.
Yeah, yeah, I did. So, and one of the things I'm most proud of in my career is I started this company called Art Media in 2002 with two friends.
Okay.
Like you would, you know, with a startup.
Yeah.
We often joke it's two guys and a dog in a basement. Nobody would publicly claim who was a dog, but regardless. So, and literally that, but that company, 23 years on, is still in business. So our media is still there. It started really as a services business. I was in services before technology services, and I'm a technologist by profession. But we effectively became a federal services integrator, like a system integrator.
Okay.
Small side for very much, but really focused around kind of rich content solutions, what we now call like NoSQL databases and things like this. So that was really my background, dealing with non-relational data and unstructured data.
Yep.
So I liked that work, and we grew the company from literally just the three of us to, you know, well over 100 employees. And again, it's sustainable. It was organic. I know how to, I've learned how to build organic businesses. And that was a great experience. However, I'd got to a point where what I really wanted to do was to build something that had, it was more about an innovation that could scale without me,
right?
Or without the original people, a product and something that could then really become useful, not just because I was useful, but because it was useful.
Yep.
And I think that
I know that feeling all too well.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, I mean, you've been...
I know that feeling all too well. With Launchpad, same story. Exactly. So in the end, that company, I'm guessing you productized, kind of systematized the internals of that company so that it could run without you, that it could scale without you, because otherwise you're not having a liquidity event. If it's dependent on Jim's never going anywhere.
Exactly. And then the good thing is, again, this is, you know, with any business, ultimately it does come down to your team, your culture, your ability to withstand downs. I mean, ups are good for everyone, but there's a lot of, there are tough times, and how do you survive it? How do you grow? How do you like deal with things that you don't know, but still can handle, because, you know, the basic blueprint of how you're running a company actually makes sense. So we went through all of that.
Okay.
Right? So I got to a point where I could leave, and really the other two guys, John and James, could continue, and it would be okay. And I continued like for a year as a on the board and things like, just so the transition wasn't disruptive. But we had really largely built, if you like, a blueprint that could lead to succession planning. It wasn't like always all about, you know, Jim or Ken or whoever. It was about the company. So I love that, because that means that you're going about doing this stuff, you know, with a long-term sustainability point of view, not just because, you know, you're singularly good or credible in a certain area.
Well, and let me hyper-focus on that a little bit, because, you know, I don't know who's going to listen to this podcast. I don't know if it's going to be my wife and my daughter and that's it, or if there's going to be a whole community, but, you know, I'm heavily involved in the venture capital accelerator, incubator, startup space in Sacramento and Silicon Valley area. So I see the best and the worst of ideas, but something that is pretty consistent that I see is, as a CEO, what is your plan to step away from the company? Like, how do you remove yourself from the equation? Early on, you got to be there strategically. You got to be there to develop the product. And as a services company, how did you do that?
So, not easily, to be honest, because if I had my druthers, I probably would have left our business maybe 3 years before, because we had done a lot of things, and I consider myself motivated by building, if you like, this 0-1 concept,
yep,
the Peter Thiel 0-1.
Yep.
And I think that's where I get excited. That's where I think I have maybe better skills or more skills and certainly more motivation than maybe a lot of people. But then there are other people who are much better at operational.
Right.
Or, you know, and extending and scaling once something is built. I think of it in my mind in this concept of shading the negative space. I like to kind of see things that maybe are not there and just shade a negative space because then objects emerge. But then I'm not necessarily the person that, you know, wants to draw everything out and you know, extend the company and operate it, you know, in whatever form and shape it takes. So all to say, with this understanding that that was my nature, and then my partners were more of the, you know, we can, you know, operate it, keep the lights on, extend it, but continuing this path, we were really at a place where we needed to get the business financially from repeatability of our services, frankly, from leadership, from even like from kind of office culture and things like this, in a place where any kind of a transition, and also frankly, from a financial exit, like packaging, was all realistic. And it took a while. I mean, it took a few years. But I think the reason why it worked was that the original founding team, we all worked really well together and we had experienced difficult times that we all managed to essentially provide the same level of sacrifice and drive and I guess if you like guts and whatever it took at a time to get through it. So and the company had seen that. So it was never about just it's the CEO or whoever. Most of our success and the culture that we had developed was seen as this team. Mm-hmm. And then in turn we imputed that to other teams and other employees. So it was never really about just one person. That made it easier. But all that being said, though, going back to your question, Ken, in a services company, it's not easy to just take one or two key people and say, well, we're going to keep going in exactly the same way. The thing that really helped us, and I mentioned this briefly, is that we were doing services for the federal government and with intelligence agencies and some other places where it's difficult to break into. But once you do break into, and so long as you do a good job, you can essentially renew contracts and continue. You have past calls, you know, as it's called. Yeah. It's easier to continue it once you break in. So that certainly helped, right? Because now that was a business that could be sustained without any one individual necessarily being there. So that was, you know, in a kind of a meandering multi-year process, that's really what happened. So the strength of the contracts, the strength of the finances, the culture, and then allowing us to tweak some of the, if like management responsibilities, and then getting to a place where effectively I could leave.
So, but and I think what I'm hearing in there is like creating a system of replicability. And then in particular, you were able to identify a service niche. So where you had government contracts, it's like the requirements don't change a lot with government contracts. You might have more work.
Yes.
But the requirements still fall within the skill set of the replicable teams that you've generated.
Precisely.
So it's almost like you've productized a service, a specific service for a specific audience.
Exactly. And I think
I think this is important to think about just in general. If you think any startup, if you don't know who your audience is and you can't build a replicable service, like it's always going to be dependent on the person who's solving the problem. It's always a new problem. And the person who's capable of solving that problem, generally a very expensive person or a founder who has the incentive to solve that problem, is going to be stuck dealing with problem solving versus we now have patterns we know how to solve, and we have systems for solving that problem. And there might be variability between the specific problems, but they're close enough that I can train and replicate teams around solving that problem.
Yeah, precisely. I think a lot of it really, honestly, at least from my perspective, and I've seen this, you know, working at the CVC, smaller places, bigger places, is do you intentionally build a culture that allows you to remove yourself or any one person from the mix without breaking either the culture or the organization. And that's not easy. Again, yeah. I saw this a lot working for the government, and you know, I harp on this idea of culture, but it's, when it comes to software development, it is so hugely important. If you don't have the right culture, which includes a technical culture, it's not just like core values and pie in the sky things. Well, I'm not talking about success stories, you know, things that you write down and you repeat. It's really much more kind of things that become part of the DNA and the fabric of what you're doing every day.
Yes.
Right? Including the tools that you use. And including, frankly, like pricing contracts, including being able to deliver. Delivery for a services company, you know this, Ken.
Yeah.
Delivery is the acid test. If you cannot deliver, all bets are off. Now, everything else then becomes aspirational. So it took a while, but anyway, again, I'm very proud of that work. The company, our media, is still continuing, like I mentioned, very well. But, you know, it got to a place where I was able to leave and do things that I was really excited by, and they could continue to do what they were doing.
So we got to let Solomon in here. I know, here, let me go open the door for him real quick.
Well, I am.
Go and meet yourself. I'm waiting.
I don't see the whole
channel. So we're in. I'll meet him up after.
I don't mind that. Noise than ours.
Lehman's going to be talking.
Yeah. We can finish this up while they're talking. I don't mind. Actually, you know what? Why don't we just... Nah, we'll keep it going. I don't care. I'll cut it out. I don't care. We're at a party right now. We can talk at a party with people in the background. I'm okay with that. You just may have to get a little bit closer to your mic.
We are at the party.
No, I think this is incredibly valuable. And that company you exited from, and then you went to CDC on contract?
I went there as what is called a time-limited permanent employee. I was hired as an entrepreneur residence, which is an unusual, it's not a typical government role. At that time, the administration was looking to bring outsiders in with experience, particularly in building large-scale solutions, and really have them help modernize, in our case, public health.
Incredible. And then, obviously, that leads you into the Acor story.
Yes.
And I know you wanted to correct something I said earlier about, you know, you're playing with the Swirls SDK, but really you were looking for the public ledger.
Exactly.
That's what you were looking for.
We loved the potential.
Yeah.
We loved the premise of the technology. But like I was mentioning, there were two issues that we saw at that time. One, it was private. It was a private implementation. And our whole belief was that for us, our use cases, a public blockchain was the direction to go. And the other thing was that it seemed proprietary, you know, with the patent.
Right.
You know, and both of those things obviously were addressed in time.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we have a public ledger with hybrid governance that has full transparency. And it's like you were talking about HCS being your favorite thing in the world on stage, like HCS, the consensus service on Hedera. Everything's transparent. Exactly. And I think that's the real value proposition we're talking about here is you almost get like public notarization, like attestation of events happening on the Acor platform.
Exactly.
Is exactly like the value proposition of Acor of how do we apply those principles into the healthcare space and specifically health records, correct?
Health records, population level data, reporting across your section. I mean, there are a number of use cases, patient incentivization to engage. But the underlying premise is very much this idea that we could provide public cryptographic proofs, attestations, if you like.
Awesome. And I'm not going to go into the Acor stuff because people can listen to about Acor everywhere else. So, but thank you so much for, I mean, probably a good 30 minutes, 40 minutes maybe,
sure,
of just talking about Jim, because I think that's the enigma we all wanted to see. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Ken.
And I'll definitely see you around the Hedera space.
No doubt. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Cheers.